This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket, and T20 is raging round the world of cricket at the moment, with, of course, England in New Zealand, with Australia playing Pakistan, having easily beaten Sri Lanka in a three-match T20 series. Bangladesh are on tour in India playing T20 matches. And also there's been the World T20 qualifiers in Dubai, with a new name entering the World T20 in 12 months' time. That's going to be Papua New Guinea, who could be in England's group. So that's fascinating. We've also got to talk about one or two slightly lower points of the game. Both Shakib Al-Hassan, who's been banned for 2 years, one of those suspended for not reporting approaches from bookies, and also the sad news that Glenn Maxwell is taking some time out of the game to manage his mental health. So lots of interesting things to talk about. Simon Mann, the first thing, you're out in New Zealand following England around. What I want to know is, have you still got the shorts on?
Do you know, Yaz, I have. I'm sitting here in my motel in Nelson and I've got my shorts on. It's been an absolutely fantastic day in Nelson today. What wonderful weather. We've actually been pretty lucky so far with the weather. It was decent in Christchurch, not particularly warm. It was decent at Wellington, but wonderful weather in Nelson. I think Nelson, actually, which is on the north coast of the South Island, is the sunniest place in New Zealand. It is officially the sunniest place in New Zealand. England play the third T20 international of the series a little bit later this week. Yep, still got the shorts on, and justifiably so. I mean, I kept the shorts on right until the end of October back in England. I toughed it out, but here is definitely shorts weather.
You put the mockers on the game tomorrow now. There's going to be rain falling now with all that. But so England won all so far, obviously five matches in the series. And clearly it's a different sort of England because there's no Stokes, Butler, Root, Archer, Moeen Ali. You know, there's a number of players missing, no Jason Roy. So it's very much kind of looking at the second line of defence, if you like, for England. And when I say the word defence, I suppose, actually, that's what I think of as bowlers in T20. It's not a bowling attack, it's a bowling defence with all the sort of intimidatory batting going on. So how have the one or two of the new England bowlers, do you think, fared so far?
Well, I think there's been a certain amount of promise. It's very early days in the competition, in the series. You know, they've only had two matches, one of which they won comfortably in Christchurch. It was actually quite a straightforward victory. And then the second game, they didn't bowl particularly badly. What they did do was they caught really poorly. James Vince dropped three catches, two of which should have been taken. David Malan dropped a catch as well, and there was a difficult chance for Sam Billings. So actually, the bowling was, you know, it was a difficult ground on which to defend. Very short square boundaries at the Westpac Stadium, the Cape Tin in Wellington, and very long straight boundaries. So it was a real challenge for the bowlers, and it was a challenge for the fielders as well, because a lot of the fielders on one side of the ground were looking into the sun, and that was one of the reasons why the catches went down. But actually, I don't think that England lost the second game because of their bowling. I think they lost it because of their batting. I think it was a game they really could have won, but they lost two wickets very early on. Johnny Bairstow out first ball, and they just didn't quite have enough in the batting. I think 176 was a reasonable bowling effort on that ground. Lots of young bowlers. I mean, Sam Curran's played his first T20 international here, which is a bit bizarre actually, because you think of him as being relatively experienced international cricketer now, but it was his first T20 international in Christchurch. Pat Brown has played a couple of matches. Saki Mahmood has come in and played. Lewis Gregory took a wicket with his first ball in international cricket. What about that? Come in and he didn't bowl in the first game, took a wicket with his first ball. But it's strange actually. It does feel like it is a very experimental England side, and it does feel as if we're sort of feeling our way back into international cricket after the drama of the summer, after the World Cup win, after the incredible Ashes series, the 2-2 in the Ashes. And I'd say it's low key, but it really does feel as if England are feeling their way back in. And lots of new names to commentate on, to speak to, post match interviews, that sort of thing. You're getting to know a sort of whole raft of new players out here. Many of which will not be part of England's World Cup T20 squad in 11 months' time in Australia. They simply won't, because the big guns will be back. But possibly there are one or two places on offer in the squad, and that's what everyone out here is fighting for.
I suppose if you look at the crowds, there was a good crowd at Christchurch, but not so good in Wellington. And the crowds in the Australia, Sri Lanka and Australia-Pakistan series that have been going on have been poor, except for, funnily enough, the visitors. Sri Lankan fans pouring into the Melbourne cricket ground, and lots of Pakistanis following their team in Sydney, but not many Australians, I don't think, in the grounds, and probably not many New Zealanders in the ground at Wellington. I wonder whether, is it rugby fever that's still commanding attention, or is it perhaps just that people have had too much cricket and that the summers haven't quite got going in either of those countries?
My sense here is that we've only had the two matches, and you rightly said Christchurch actually was a really good crowd, and it looked good as well because the grassy banks were full with about 6,000 people. I mean, I think the problem at the Cape Tin in Wellington is it's a rugby ground, capacity of 25,000, and so unless you have a really big crowd in, it is going to look a little bit empty. It might well be the fact that it's the start of the season. It's spring here in New Zealand. Although the sun was out in Wellington, it wasn't particularly warm. And I suppose the rugby season has only just finished. The World Cup final was the night before. Okay, New Zealand weren't in it, and it might be that the season hasn't quite got going, hasn't captured the imagination. I think the key is here in New Zealand is to play matches on ground, the outgrounds, if you like, the sort of more intimate grounds. Christchurch is like that with the grassy banks. Nelson's like that with its grassy banks. Mount Maunganui, where the first test match is going to be played, is a bit like that as well. It'll be fascinating actually to see how many people turn up for that. So, part of it is the fact that, the second game was played on the ground, really, that's designed for rugby, and you're playing a cricket match. If you'd had that crowd at Christchurch, you would have been absolutely heaving, and it would look fantastic on television, for example. But I don't think it looked great on television, certainly back at home in that huge stadium at the Cape Tin, which is designed for big rugby crowds. And there's no doubt about it that rugby, we know that rugby is the game here. Rugby has got the massive mass following in the way that football has in the UK, and cricket is always scrabbling for attention.
Did you know that 53 New Zealanders played in various rugby teams in the World Cup that were not New Zealand? So if you add the New Zealand squad itself to all the other teams. There were something like 83 New Zealanders playing in the Rugby World Cup. And was there a bit of ribbing from the Kiwis during that final? Or are they still smarting from their semi-final loss?
Well, I think a bit of both. We watched the game in a bar in Wellington. It was a 10 o'clock kickoff in the evening, local time in Wellington. And you got the sense that the locals were supporting South Africa. It was sort of like anyone but England after what happened the week before. It might well be that, you know, generally speaking, England rugby team is not the most liked team around the world, so there might have been an element of that, but we had to sit there in silence for most of the match because England didn't play particularly well, and they were sort of engulfed by a magnificent South African display. And I think it's fair to say the bar we were in, the crowd were pretty enthusiastic when South Africa ran in those late tries to confirm their victory. It was we sort of retreated as soon as the final whistle went. We retreated pretty quickly. Admittedly, it was about midnight, and we're all suffering from jet lag anyway. So yeah, there's a good excuse to leave the bar.
It actually reminds me of a bit of. I spent a lot of time in New Zealand in the 1980s, and it was in the early days of world coverage of cricket, so you could get Australian cricket in New Zealand for the first time, really. And the New Zealanders absolutely loved, after practice at a club ground, we'd go to a place called the Ellerslie Oaks in Auckland, which had a satellite feed of Australian cricket, Channel 9 coverage. And they would just revel in seeing the Australians ritually trounced by the West Indies. So there's that you know, arch rivalry, obviously, between New Zealand and Australia. And the New Zealanders, they loved seeing Australia hammered by that amazing 1980s West Indies team. Actually, New Zealand cricket is a bit of a throwback, isn't it? Even now, I mean, if you look at those grounds like they are, it does feel like sort of 1980s England in a way. And there is that saying, isn't there, the air in New Zealand is so clear, if you climb a hill, you can see back 40 years.
Do you know, it's funny you should say that. I arrived in Christchurch on Friday, actually on the day of the game. I came in from the USA on Friday, and there were so few people in the centre of Christchurch around the hotel I was staying at. I actually said to the woman on reception, "Is it a public holiday today?" And she looked at me slightly bemused, saying, no, it's just a normal working day. But I mean, Christchurch has clearly got its problems because, you know, after following the earthquake, and there's a lot of rebuilding going on, I think quite a lot of people left the city, and it, you know, it's gradually getting back on its feet. But I can tell you, it is very different from London, where there's one person for every square inch. In Christchurch, it is not like that at all.
Any other performances to pick out from England?
Well, James Vince. I mean, what a curious couple of matches he has had. He batted superbly in the first game. The James Vince that we all know is in there, really, as an international cricketer. I think we all sense that he's got something, and he showed it in the first match. Really clean striking of the ball. He was frustrated to get out towards the end, when actually he could have had a red inker and seen England over the line. And then the next game, he drops two absolute goobers and then gets caught on the square cover boundary, an unusual dismissal, but actually symptomatic of the fact that the square boundaries were very short. So he sort of drove a ball, got a thickish outside edge, and was caught on the deep cover boundary. It's not something you see very often in any cricket, really. So he's sort of one of those cricketers that you're drawn to him because he's got that talent. And of course, with Joe Denley being injured, having turned his ankle, he's got ankle ligament damage, just the possibility there might be a place in the test squad for another batsman, be it James Vince, who knows, David Milland, Johnny Bairstow's out here as well. Just a question of what they're going to do about that. But so Vince performed really well in the first game, not so well in the second. And then the second game, that old stalwart, we all talk about Jofra Archer, with his Barbados backgrounds, come over and played in England, has been really successful. Of course, there's you know, Chris Jordan, he's very similar background, they're great friends. Jordan had a magnificent game in the second match, wickets, canny bowling, and then you know, whacked the ball everywhere and gave England a chance of victory. And he's had actually quite a good year in T20 for England because he bowled very well in the West Indies before the World Cup, 4 for 6. Admirable cricketer, and you know, it's good to see that he's still on the scene and still doing well. You know, there's a lot of young bowlers out here trying to sort of vie for places. You know, the likes of Brown and Curran and Saki Mahmood, but it's all an old stager, Chris Jordan, who's canny and showing the younger ones how to do it.
OK, well, I've been covering for BT Sport Australia playing their T20 matches against both Sri Lanka and also now Pakistan. And actually, one amazing story, really, from that series, David Warner, who averaged 9 in the Ashes in 5 tests, and in 4 T20 matches so far this summer, he hasn't been dismissed. He's scored nearly 300 runs, some against the Sri Lankans and just a couple actually against Pakistan in the first match, which was rained off. But he hasn't got out. He's been dropped a couple of times. But the difference in the way Warner has batted against the white ball compared to the red is quite stunning. He's back to his old best. He's been, you know, pummeling the ball to all parts. He's looked totally confident, smiles back. Steve Smith, of course, has carried on his relentless pursuit of runs as well. And the Australians just looked in a totally different league to Sri Lanka. So quite a lot of these T20 matches or series around have thrown up some strange results because Sri Lanka were in Pakistan and beat Pakistan 3-0, but then came to Australia and looked totally second rate, a really ordinary side who just, it was men against boys with Australia winning 3-0. Pakistan now in Australia with a slightly better chance of making some inroads into Australia. They've got 4 left-arm fast bowlers, amazingly. And one of them is this Mohammed Afan, who we've seen, you know, many times before, 7'1", probably the tallest international player ever playing the game. And so, you know, a lot of quite interesting sort of stuff going on. And the amount of T20 cricket around the world now is incredible, isn't it?
Well, we've reached 1,000 T20s. That India-Bangladesh game was 1,000 T20s in 14 years. I think I'm right in saying that in terms of 50-over cricket or one-day international cricket, longer form, short form, if you see what I mean, it took them 24 years to reach 1,000 one-day internationals. So, you know, T20, we know, is taking over. It is more prominent. And, of course, we're a year away from a T20 World Cup in Australia. We've just had the qualifying tournament for that. And Namibia have qualified, the Netherlands have qualified, Scotland, Ireland, Oman and Papua New Guinea into a pre-qualifying tournament. And it's a bit complicated for the tournament in Australia next year. Bangladesh and Sri Lanka are the other teams in there in a four-team group. Bangladesh, Namibia, Netherlands, Scotland in one group, Ireland, Oman, Papua New Guinea and Sri Lanka in the other. So, you know, everyone's building up to that. And the T20 theme will continue throughout the next year because teams are playing more and more T20 cricket in preparation for the T20 World Cup in a year's time. You know, there was a time when the ICC would say, right, you know, you can only, on a tour, you know, one game maximum, you know, or two games maximum. But that seems to be, you know, being relaxed now. And, you know, we're in a 5-match series here in New Zealand. England will play 3 T20s in South Africa. There'll be more T20s in England next summer because the focus, you know, we've had the 50-over World Cup. And now the focus is very much on the T20 World Cup in Australia next year. I mean, just looking at England's group, for example, they definitely play South Africa, India, and Afghanistan. There's a good chance that Bangladesh will be in there as well. And then the second place from the Ireland, Oman, Papua New Guinea and Sri Lanka group. So, you know, they may well end up with Ireland as well, or even Papua New Guinea, who knows? So that's going to be their 5 opponents, South Africa, India, Afghanistan, possibly Bangladesh, possibly Papua New Guinea or Ireland, and then, well, they'll hope into a semi-finals. But it's all gearing up towards that. And the other bizarre thing as well is it's not just a World T20 or a T20 World Cup next year, but there's one the year after in India as well. It's sort of back to back. So it feels like an irresistible force. The T20 game, we know it from, you know, the franchise cricket that's played around the world, and it's happening in the international game as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, it really is the ICC's attempt to grow the game. This is where they see the format they see is best suited to growing the game. And they made an announcement about a year ago that all associate members were now, if they played a T20 against each other, that would count as a T20 international. So there are now actually 104 countries that can play T20 internationals. And it's a great story that a team like Papua New Guinea, tiny little country, are now qualifying or have qualified for the qualifier part of the World T20 in Australia. So they're going to be part of that tournament in a year's time. And the celebrations you could see on the field in Dubai when they qualified, and also when Namibia qualified, were fantastic. I mean, it's just great to see that these players who, then a lot of them are now sort of full-time cricketers. They might not play cricket every day, but they play cricket a lot of the time and then coach or work in the game in some other capacity. So they are sort of effectively professional cricketers. And all the Papua New Guineas, whereas a lot of countries' teams quite often are drawing from the great Indian diaspora, so expat Indians in, you know, America or Malaysia or the UAE or wherever it is. But in terms of Papua New Guinea, all the team are Papuans, and they have a really rich cricketing heritage there, which has been going on for many years. Of course, Geraint Jones is their most famous export, but they are genuine, you know, passionate cricket fans with a very good infrastructure around Port Moresby and elsewhere. Their coach is the former Australian bowling coach Joe Dawes, and you know, they just have a sort of rich tapestry of players. I think they're going to cause a few surprises if they make it through to the later stages of the T20 World Cup. They could surprise a few people because they've got some very good hitters and some decent spinners as well, and one good left armer. So, you know, they are quite a talented team. And the reason why the ICC see T20 as the way to grow the game is just because you don't need quite the depth of resources, infrastructure, even money, to sustain a T20 team as much as you do a test team with the first-class structure that you need to have in place to really produce a decent test team. That's what someone like Ireland are finding out. You know, unless you have a really sort of quite rich first-class structure, it's very difficult to produce a consistent test team. But T20 is a format of the game where you don't need quite the level of sophistication, perhaps, than you would to mount a sort of test challenge. And so it's quite encouraging to see, actually, that, you know, these countries are coming through, and there are now, you know, about 20 reputable T20 international teams.
The other point as well, of course, is that if you're not successful in a T20 match, and you know you're vulnerable because you haven't got that quality, the game doesn't last for as long. You're not absolutely thrashed. You know, if you're playing a test match and you're really not up to standard, you know, you can lose by an innings and 300 runs. If you play a one-day international, you can get beaten by 230 runs. But in a T20 match, A, if you're getting thrashed, it's over quickly, and B, probably the size of the defeat is not so great. So in a way, you know, the shorter the game, the greater chance of the upset as well, which helps, you know, which is a factor in encouraging lesser teams. And I would be surprised if Papua New Guinea, if they were to qualify, which they could well do, qualify for the sort of Super 12 stage of the T20 World Cup in Australia in a year's time. I would be surprised if they upset the big teams. But that's part of the development, isn't it? You get to feel what it's like playing in those big tournaments. And of course, then, you know, if there's one the year after as well, then the experience you gain from being in one tournament, you can take over into the next tournament.
It was pretty one-sided, the Australia-Sri Lanka series, actually, having said all that. Australia only lost 6 wickets in the 3 games, and one of them, they scored 233 for 2, and Sri Lanka was 99 all out. So it was a bit one-sided, actually, the Australia-Sri Lanka series. Now, in that series, Glenn Maxwell played in the first 2 games, and he batted brilliantly in the first game. Typical Maxwell, came in and sort of reverse lapped the fast bowlers and belted them over deep mid wicket, and you know, he looked absolutely to the manner born, as we all know, in his T20 format, and he actually was also mic'd up for talking to the commentators, and he was really funny, and he almost became one of the commentators. He was sort of commentating on a ball as it was being bowled, and then ran in and fielded it and kind of commentated on that. So it was very engaging. And then, quite surprisingly, the announcement came before the third match that he was not feeling well and that he had problems with his mental health and he'd be taking some time out of the game. And everybody leapt to his defence and said, you know, what a shame, how sad, give him all the support he needs. But it's amazing, isn't it, that how deceptive this kind of situation can be. Chris Lynn, who's a good friend of his, actually put it quite well. He said, you know, cricketers are like icebergs. You know, you see that sort of stuff on the surface, but there's all that depth going on below, which you don't see. And that clearly, Maxwell was having these problems of dealing with the pressure of being an international sportsman, and they were getting too much for him. It's quite sad to see, but I wonder if, you know, it is part of a wider issue. You mentioned about all these T20 internationals being played, 1,000 in 10 years or something. I mean, are we just playing too much cricket and people can't cope?
Well, you never know what's going on in someone's mind. Cricket is such a tough game mentally. I know international sport generally is, you know, it is ruthless, but cricket in particular, you've got, as you know, Yoz, yourself, you've got so much time to think about and contemplate your success or failure, and your success or failure is so clear, you know, in a scorecard, it's unequivocal. You know, unlike many other sports, you think of, you know, rugby and football. I know there are many more stats in those sorts of sports now, but you know, you can make one mistake in cricket, and that is the end of your day or the end of your match almost. So it is a really mentally tough sport to cope with, and clearly, you know, it does undermine lots of players. We've seen that, you know, in recent years. You know, you think of someone like Marcus Trescothick, you think of Jonathan Trott, and, you know, there are many more examples as well. Cricket is a bloody tough sport.
Yeah, well, we wish Glenn Maxwell well and a speedy recovery. And there's one sort of other sad note to talk about, which I mentioned at the start, and that is Shakib Al Hassan being banned for 2 years for not reporting approaches from bookies. One of those 2 years is a suspended sentence, so he will probably be only out of the game for a year, provided he behaves himself in the meantime. But it does show that that there is still this awful potential for match fixing looming over the game. And you know, we mention about all these hundreds of T20 internationals going on. Each one of them is susceptible to all sorts of manipulation.
The fascinating thing here, I think, is the fact that the ICC have changed their approach, it would appear, to try to come to terms with match fixing, spot fixing, whatever you like to call it, in that it's so difficult to nail down players by, you know, things like wiretaps or investigating their bank accounts. You know, there's a change of policy, and that is to now take on players who do not report approaches. They all go through all the education programs. They know that if they don't report an approach, they are liable to be suspended, and that's what's happened in the Shakib Al Hassan case. And that's the way the ICC are going. That's their approach at the moment, to try to catch players who are guilty of offences under their match-fixing code. And it is my understanding that it's not finished. You know, there may well be other players named in the next week or so. And in some ways, you say it's good that the authorities are trying to come to terms with, get to grips with the problem of match fixing, spot fixing. Whether they can eradicate it completely, I don't know. I doubt it. But at least there is a policy at the moment which is now dealing with players. And that, you know, you think of someone like Shakib El-Sani, that is a really prominent name in the game. I mean, he had a fantastic World Cup. He was a prominent figure in the World Cup for Bangladesh in the summer. There's been a lot of comment about it in Bangladesh, you know, saying, you know, it is ridiculous that a player has been banned for a couple of years, one year suspended for not reporting an approach. Well, first thing I say about that is all the players know they're supposed to report the approaches. But also what's interesting is that Shakib has accepted, he's actually released a statement saying, you know, he accepts his punishment. He knows that he's done wrong. And in a way that is saying to all those people who are trying to support him, look, you know, don't take offence at the fact that I have been banned. You know, I'm banged to rights.
Yeah, and I mean, I've got no sympathy either. I mean, all these players are educated regularly about the tactics of bookies and other people sort of hovering around the game. And one of the tactics used commonly at the moment is by illegal bookmakers tapping up coaching staff, net bowlers, or indeed players, if they can get at them, for inside information on possible formats, batting first, bowling first, people who might open the batting, targets in power play, overs. And how they manage to get their information is quite often by ingratiating themselves with that player or that coach, buying them dinner, in some cases providing women for them. That's another tactic. And sort of gradually getting their claws into that person, whether it's a player or a coach or a net bowler, so that they then sort of almost feel duty bound to offer advice back. And it's that kind of exchange of things like WhatsApp messages which can in the end incriminate a player or a coach. And that's what the ICC are looking out for, is to try and find these illegal bookmakers and see who they interact with, and then they can identify the players or coaches who've been communicating with them. Obviously, one of the problems, and people will say, well, why are players still getting lured into these kind of communications? And I suppose that the simple answer is that with players like from Sri Lanka or Bangladesh, for example, they're not paid anything like the money that the players from England, Australia, India and other countries are paid. And they're just, they're being greedy, but they're also being opportunistic and trying to make up for the fact that they're not paid as much as other countries. And that's not really an excuse, but you can sort of see why it happens.
Yeah, and it's very difficult to catch players in the act. I think that's the point, isn't it? You need a wiretap. You need a sort of Hansi Cronje situation where you know you're actually caught making a telephone call, where you're, you know, liaising with the bookie and saying what you're going to do, and that's obviously what happened with with Hansi Cronje, and those tapes when the Delhi police had that tape of Hansi Cronje speaking, and that, you know, everyone's eyes were open to that. But it's not easy. It's very, very difficult to get that sort of evidence, and you know, it's very difficult to investigate people's bank accounts, and that's why the ICC are going down the road of nailing players for not reporting approaches from bookmakers. It seems sort of innocuous in a way. Oh, you know, a bookie approaches you, tries to get you to fix a match, you just sort of brush it off in theory and you don't say anything. Well, that, you know, the players know that is not good enough. If they are approached, they have to report it. And Shakib El-Hassan has been done under that aspect of the ICC code.
And of course, what is tempting all these bookmakers into this activity is the number of T20 and One Day Internationals being shown on TV, so that you know, they are all an opportunity to bet, even women's games, even domestic games, they'll bet on. And hundreds of millions of dollars are bet on on some of these games. So there's a huge amount of margin for people to make a lot of money with just a little tiny bit of information here or there. So, you know, it is something that desperately needs more resources to stamp out, and probably, as you say, will never do it completely. It's always been something that's sort of gone on, isn't it, in cricket, even kind of slightly informally, like the time when I was playing for Durham against a touring team, and while we were blocking out for a draw, and this touring team needed to win 8 out of 9 county matches to get a bonus. And so one of their players offered me £100 to get out. It's the first time anyone's offered me £100 to get out. And I said, well, you'll have to offer me a lot more than that. And then I got run out sort of soon after. So the bet was off. And I wasn't run out deliberately. But it is something that I guess the authorities are grappling with. And it seems like, and your point earlier was, that they're sort of starting to find a few bigger targets, which sends a very powerful message that you don't do it.
Yeah, it's a change of strategy. I think the biggest problem with it is, and I've thought this for a long time now, is once we started to know that match fixing was going on, when it came out in the 1990s, when we started to realise that this was happening, that the problem is with it is you see incidents on the field now, and they might be perfectly normal run of events, but you start to think that looks suspicious. You know, why did that player drop a catch? You know, why did the player get out? Why did the bowler bowl that delivery? You know, that point of the over. Once you start to doubt the game, then it sort of undermines its credibility. I mean, I'm not saying anything particularly new here, but it is that point you lose that sense of wonderment of the game, that the fact that you can have unpredictable activities in a match. You start to think, oh, well, is what I'm seeing real, or is it being manufactured? And that is what is so insidious. And I'm sceptical about the ability of the authorities to totally come to terms with the problem. But, you know, if you are nailing someone high profile like Shakib Ul Hassan, then you are making some progress. Clearly, you know, it is a marker to players who might be tempted to be involved in this. I mean, one of the problems, of course, is that if you're in so deep, then how do you get out of it as a player? You know, if you have been entrapped at a young age, how do you then extricate yourself from that? Are you always in hock to the bookmakers? And that, you know, that is one of the games. You know, it is a huge problem facing the game, and clearly it is still going on, and everyone should have their eyes open to it.
Very, very well put. Incidentally, it didn't stop the lack of having Shakib Ul Hassan didn't stop Bangladesh from beating India in the first T20 international in India. So that was an impressive scalp. Well, listen, we'll leave it there. We will continue to report back on the T20 fiesta going on around the world over the next few weeks. We'll be back with you next Monday, when actually I'm doing a special report on minorities in England and how we can engage them better in the game. So, Simon, enjoy your odyssey around New Zealand and keep the shorts on.
I plan to, although I'm told after sunshine in Nelson it's going to rain for the rest of the week. But let's keep our fingers crossed for the rest of the T20 series. England go to Napier, and then they go to Auckland. And then we talk about T20 fiesta after that. Then it's focused on the test series. England got two warm-up matches in Whangarei, which is in the North Island of New Zealand, and then two test matches. And England have experimented with their T20 squad, but they are not experimenting that much with their test squad. All the big players are coming out here. But having said that, Dominic Sibley and Zach Crawley will be out here, and a great opportunity for them in a week or so's time to stake their claim for a test place.
Well done on your pronunciation of Whangarei, by the way. Hope you've enjoyed it, and thanks for listening.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.